This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning. Good morning. It's about 4 minutes after 8 o'clock. You are listening to Positively Revolting. I'm your host, Ani, and I'm here with Lynn, the
yes,
other host.
Yes, you are. The other host. The co-host.
Co-host. Co-host Lynn. Co-host Ani. Co-host. Okay. And this morning, we are talking about the grand jury system and three people that are currently in prison for not cooperating with the grand jury. To do that with us, we are joined by Christian Williams. Christian is a member of the Committee Against Political Repression. Christian, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's go ahead and start the conversation.
I don't see why not. I always like, we have visited the grand jury. I always want to call it a procedure because that seems to be more accurate. Before on the show, and I always learn something about what exactly that is, because I don't think people hear about, you hear a lot of the news, the grand jury, blah, 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 but you don't hear exactly what happens and what happens to people that are called upon by the grand jury and what the actual procedure, nuts and bolts procedure of that is. Can you explain that a little bit to us, Christian, and our listeners?
Sure. The grand jury is a process that the prosecutor completely controls. The there's no judge in the room. There's no defense attorney. There's a jury. There's a prosecutor, and the prosecutor basically can present whatever evidence that they want. And the normal rules that we associate with trial, things like hearsay evidence or those kinds of things that lawyers would object to, there aren't the same guards against those in the grand jury proceeding. So in principle, this was supposed to be a check on prosecutorial power, because it meant that there was supposed to be a hearing before trial where the prosecutor would present their best case and a jury would decide whether or not there was actually enough evidence to go to trial. And this was supposed to stop prosecutors from being able to put, you know, anyone on trial at any time for anything.
Well, what happened?
As it turns out, because it's entirely controlled by the prosecution, in effect, it's transformed into a tool for the prosecutor to collect more evidence that they couldn't get otherwise. And one of the ways that they do that is that they can call witnesses before a grand jury and ask them questions. And once they're in the jury room, they can ask them questions literally about anything, and all of the samples in secret. So the rather than it simply being a matter of the prosecutor presenting the evidence that they have on hand and say and asking the jury, is there enough evidence to go to trial, the prosecutor can actually use the grand jury to collect evidence that they wouldn't have access to otherwise. So, and the way that we've seen this happen most recently is the prosecutor asking for, or the prosecutor granting witnesses immunity to prosecution and then interrogating them about whatever it is that they may know that they want to have evidence on. And by granting them witness, immunity from prosecution, they therefore also eliminate the Fifth Amendment protections against self-incrimination. So in the case that that's presently unfolding in Seattle, there was a demonstration in May Day of last year in which some windows were broken from in the buildings of some major corporations and the federal courthouse. And a federal grand jury was impaneled to investigate it. The and they've been calling not people who they suspect of being involved, but people who they think have information about this. And from the notes that we've received from people from the people who have been interviewed, the questions mostly don't involve anything about particular people committing particular crimes and are much more focused broadly on anarchist organizing and who knows who and who is doing work with whom and that sort of thing.
That does seem to be what grand juries have devolved into, doesn't it?
Yes. This is not a particularly recent development. About 10 years ago, there was a lot of grand jury attention to the environmental movement. In the late 70s and early 80s, there was a lot of attention to the Puerto Rican independent movement. In the late 60s, early 70s, there was a lot of attention to the Black Liberation movement. The grand jury has become a reliable tool for the state to collect information on political movements that it couldn't collect otherwise, and also to pit people against each other, undermine solidarity, also terrorize people with the notion that they could be subpoenaed, and if they don't cooperate, they could go to jail for 18 months.
And that's
trial.
You know, that's a pretty hefty sentence for somebody who has not been actually, let alone being convicted of a crime, they're not being charged with crimes.
I would say it's actually something of a misnomer to call it a sentence, because there are no accusations, there's no trial, there's simply
detention.
You're not doing what we want, and so we're going to put you in jail.
Right. So let's actually talk about the three people that are currently being held in the Federal Detention Center, SeaTac. They are Matt Duran, Katie Olesnik, and Maddie Pfeiffer. Matt Duran and Katie Olesnik.
Olesnik,
thank you, have both been held since last September, and then Maddie Pfeiffer joining them in December.
Yep, just after Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you talk about, first of all, how they were initially grabbed, basically? Can you talk a little bit about the conditions of how at least Matthew Duran and KDO were taken?
Well, let's see. KDO was one of the first people subpoenaed, and that was in July of last year. The process here is that they send a couple FBI agents to your house or your workplace or wherever they think that they can reliably find you, and they serve you some paperwork, and the paperwork demands that you appear at the grand jury proceeding, usually a week or two later. And if you don't show, then a warrant could be issued for you. If you do show, then they're going to ask you, they'll ask questions. Assuming that you don't answer the questions, they will probably grant immunity to prosecution. And then if you continue to not answer questions, they'll take you before a judge and charge you with contempt of court. And the principle here is not that they're in prison to be punished, or not in prison to be punished, but to be coerced, meaning they're not being held for something that they've done. They're being held to make them do something that they're not doing. Matt Duran was subpoenaed, I think, about a month later in August. And then Maddie Pfeiffer was subpoenaed in September, but didn't appear until November, and then wasn't ordered to turn themselves into jail until December. So it's all... the actual mechanisms are very banal. There's not really, like, a flashy story there. Although simultaneously to KDO getting the subpoena, there were also two people here in Portland who were issued subpoenas. And those were accompanied by SWAT team raids on a couple, I think, three houses here in town. And, you know, first thing in the morning, like, literally kicking down doors, flashbang grenades. They accidentally started a fire in one of the houses that they raided. You know, automatic weapons, like, and then they searched the house for things like flags, black clothing, anarchist literature, road flares.
Boy, black clothing, they're going to have a lot in Portland to get people with black clothing. That is pretty seditious. Sorry.
It is.
I don't mean to make light of this at all, because it's not, but it's just the absurdity of it.
It's ridiculous enough that you kind of have to.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Looking for literature and types of clothing, that is...
Black clothing in Portland? I can't believe it.
I just
got
to say, you know, it underscores the aspect of this is done for political motivations.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what they were looking for was basically protest materials and material pointing to the ideological orientation of the people that they were investigating. And if you look at the affidavit that the FBI swore out to get a search warrant to monitor some of the cell phones that they had taken, it makes it explicitly clear that what they were looking for are anarchists and evidence of anarchism. And interestingly, one of the things that affidavit refers to is looking for information on the conspirators, meaning the people who committed the crimes in Seattle, and their associates. So they're not even pretending to narrowly tailor this to actual violations of the law. They're looking much broader to the movement as a whole.
So just to underscore and be clear, the three people that are currently incarcerated in federal detention center in Seattle have not been charged with any crime. And yet now they have also been moved into the special housing unit, as I understand, which is otherwise known as solitary confinement.
Two of them, Matt Duran and Katie Olesnik, the last I've heard, now have cellmates. But they're still in administrative segregation, so they are limited in terms of, like, exercise hours. They don't really have any contact with, you know, the general population of the prison. They're basically, you know, in a very small room with a stranger all the time. Maddie Pfeiffer is, on the other hand, completely isolated, and has not even reliably been able to get in touch with her lawyer.
Has the state offered any reason at all why these three people have been held in solitary?
Not as far as I know.
Okay.
And apparently they don't have to.
Apparently they don't, because they're the state. All right. I just want to remind folks, you are listening to Positively Revolting on your very own community radio station, KBOO. I'm Ani, here with Lynn. And this morning, we are very fortunate to have Christian Williams joining us, discussing the grand jury system and how it's used as a tool of political repression. Not a new thing, as Christian just noted, but an important thing for really all of us to keep in mind. Also, discussing the people who are currently in prison for refusing to cooperate with that process. You can join us in this discussion by giving us a call at 503-231-8187 and asking your questions or commenting about this situation. You can also, of course, comment on Facebook, where you can find us at facebook.com/positivelyrevolting. And you can also email us. You can find us email-wise at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. So, you had talked about, Christian, a little bit ago, you talked about people being able to be held in federal detention for up to 18 months for non-cooperation.
18 months is pretty standard. The what the rule actually is that they can be held for as long as the grand jury is impaneled. So the notion being that they're being held to make them talk. So when the grand jury is done, there's nothing for them to talk to. So the incentive for holding them goes away. Ordinarily, grand juries are impaneled for 18 months. This one was impaneled starting in March of last year and will go until March of next year, 2014. It's also possible for grand juries to be renewed. So at the point where they expire, the prosecutor could, do whatever prosecutorial magic they do, file some paperwork, get an extension for another 18 months or 2 years, in which case, if people are being held for contempt, they could continue to be held for contempt. It's also possible that this grand jury would end, and then sometime later, they would decide to impanel another grand jury to pick up the same investigation, in which case, people could be subpoenaed again, the whole thing could start over.
So currently, we're looking at anarchists on the hot seat, an anarchist community on the hot seat, but you had mentioned prior political examples of political repression via the grand jury system. Can you explore those a little bit more?
Sure. I mean, this may be familiar to people locally because 10 years ago, also in the Pacific Northwest, there was a federal grand jury that was investigating the Earth Liberation Front. And it had subpoenaed their press officers who were, like, apparently the only handle they could get on this, like, I think dozens of times, if I remember right. And through a combination of foot dragging and pure obstinance, the people who were subpoenaed at that point didn't cooperate, also managed to keep themselves out of jail from it. Not everyone's been that lucky. During in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a lot of grand jury attention to the Puerto Rican independence movement. And that, that movement has actually had run-ins with grand juries going back to the 50s and had a long-standing tradition of people refusing to cooperate and doing time because of that. I guess I should also mention that presently, there's also a grand jury in Santa Cruz that's investigating some sort of animal rights action that I don't really know the details of. And there's an ongoing situation with the Freedom Row Socialist Organization, mostly centered in the Midwest, but with a few people pulled into it from, I think, North Carolina, if I remember right, who were called before a grand jury a couple years ago for some of their international solidarity work. So it's, the local situation at present, it's environmentalists who are under the microscope. But the process of the grand jury gives a much broader range of people reason to worry.
And apart from resisting and not testifying, that's about all folks can do at this point, or what's?
I mean, not refusing to testify, it seems to me to be just a matter of principle. I mean,
that's a huge thing.
Yeah, the McCarthyist element to the kind of investigation, I think, makes it imperative that people not give even what seems like harmless information, because it's not just prosecutions that they're after. They're after information that will help them to neutralize and break up social movements that oppose the state. The options for people who have gotten these subpoenas are pretty bleak. You can refuse to testify and they could put you in jail, or you can testify and
They could still put you in jail.
They could still put you in jail. And it will probably lead to, you know, movements that you've been involved in being at least damaged, and very likely people that you know and care about going to prison, possibly for a very long time. It's not an enviable situation.
At all. How can people actually support folks that are resisting the grand jury?
So I should start by saying that you can get updates as to how this develops by visiting CAPR's website, which is at nopoliticalrepression.wordpress.com. And we have action alerts and that sort of thing there. Also, we've been helping raise money so that the people who are in prison have money in their commissary accounts and that sort of thing. Also help their loved ones make the trip to see them, that sort of thing. Also try to make a dent in some of the legal costs. And so there's information on how to donate money also on the website. We also periodically have people calling or faxing or writing the U.S. attorney, who's Jenny Durkin, the assistant U.S. attorney in Washington, who's the person who can make all this stop. And especially when there are hearings scheduled, we've been flooding her office with phone calls. So, again, for information on that, the best thing to do is to visit the website, nopoliticalrepression.wordpress.com. Also, of course, if people are interested in organizing fundraisers, if they want to organize public education events, if they're interested in organizing demonstrations, like, all of that is needed. And our smallish helter-skelter committee is not doing it all ourselves. So if you're interested in what would be, like, how you could help, you know, also please get in touch with us.
That seems that that's sort of the it's such a complete piece of repression, the grand juries, in that if it's also draining on people's resources, and could so be used in other areas.
I mean, that's true. Like, probably the most obvious way that's true is financially, but it's also true just in terms of, like, people's time and the
and emotional drain.
And there's definitely an emotional toll, especially for, you know, people who feel like they're facing prison because of this, the people who are in prison because of this, obviously, their friends and family who suddenly have this, like, hole in their lives that previously had a person in it. And the sort of secondary stress of trying to do political work in that climate. I don't think that's incidental. I think that's largely the point. As much as the grand jury is about collecting information on the movement, it's also about making people feel precarious, making people feel like they're in danger, and putting a general chilling effect on it. I think the best we can do is organize against it and use that organizing to make the social movement stronger. It's a tall order.
Indeed. Speaking of tall orders, I don't know if that's a good segue or not. We have a caller on the line. Excuse me. Amy?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning. I've got a tall order question.
Okay.
Okay, so here's a very defensive situation where the grand jury is a tool used against people in the movement. What about the grand jury used to go for people like the war criminals who are heading up our country? How about the grand jury being used as a tool to go for the banks that are basically criminally breaking laws with the Securities Exchange Commission, et cetera? Mm-hmm. Why don't we use the tool of the grand jury to go after Obama for the drone war, for the kill list? Why don't we, the people, take charge of these mechanisms? I think of them as a mechanism. Why are we always on the defensive, trying to go and say, stop this, stop that, stop that? Who initiates the grand jury? The Attorney General of the United States?
Thanks very much for your question.
Appointed? That's a question. Mm-hmm. What's the answer?
Okay.
So the grand jury is initiated by the U.S. Attorney, who's the representative of the Justice Department in the particular area. In this case, it's Jenny Durkin, who's the U.S. attorney for Western Washington. In principle, it could be used to investigate all kinds of things, and is. I mean, they also mm-hmm. have grand juries just for regular criminal cases. But the sort of things the caller was talking about, the financial misdeeds, the war crimes, that sort of thing. I mean, the people who run it have no interest in pursuing that. So there's, I think, basically no hope of this this mechanism being turned to those ends. And some of that's because it's not a democratic institution. Like, we don't control it. So it has no real
There is
need.
No we there.
Yeah, there's no need for it to reflect our interests at all.
Sad but true. I think that really does show pretty starkly a schism, the gap between we the people and actually being able to use the mechanisms of the state mechanisms, and the people's interests are often not in concert with one another.
I couldn't agree more. However, should we go for another caller?
Let's do that.
Steve.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is, would the ACLU think this process is constitutional because the person who's being called before the grand jury has to testify against themselves and they have no legal representation? So would the ACLU offer any help? Or is there legal history that's already settled which would say the ACLU wouldn't get involved in the process?
Isn't the procedure is not that a very democratic one to start with, and it's my understanding that you can't take an attorney with you into the grand jury.
That's right.
I mean, in terms of what the ACLU thinks, I think you'd have to ask the ACLU.
Has anybody approached them to offer assistance?
This is bigger than them.
Yeah, I mean that.
I don't know what
I'm not
they
sure
could
how much
do.
I can say about that.
They could file a lawsuit, I would think. I don't know what the settled case history is. I'd like to know, but somebody ought to file a lawsuit and have it go up the chain of the federal courts, I think. I don't know if it would help or not, but I'm not sure anybody's tried.
I mean, there have definitely been constitutional challenges to this in the past. I'm not familiar enough with the law to explain exactly why those haven't worked. I think there's clearly, legally, this is more or less kosher because this is how they do it. It's not like they're sneaking around about this.
Yeah, so, I mean, to sort of go in there for a moment, I think that your question is absolutely right on. Like, how could this happen?
Right.
Why? This has to be wrong, right? Except the point being that this is actually how the system is used.
Right.
And it has been used, since the 50s and probably before, specifically in times where there is a movement that is challenging state power and state authority. And so given that, this is actually the way that the state works this part of the game.
I mean, I think there's a... there's a sort of prima facie problem here where on the face of it, it seems like forcing people to testify makes a mockery of the Fifth Amendment. The seizing of the kinds of evidence that we were talking about, things like political literature, things like protest materials, seems to make a mockery of the First Amendment. Like, clearly there's like some sort of short circuit between the norms of constitutionality and the way that the law is actually being operable. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know enough about how the law works to explain the legal gymnastics that are involved there. I think ultimately the solution is going to be a political one, not a legal one, and it's going to require political pressure rather than simply hoping that the courts see reason.
Right. As we have seen plenty of evidence.
That's
sadly,
a great sentence. I like that. Hoping
yes.
that the courts see reason. Yeah.
You can join in the conversation if you would like by calling us at 503-231-8187. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn. Our guest this morning is Christian Williams. We are talking about grand juries and grand jury resistance, also the pointed use of grand juries for political repression. Again, 503-231-8187. Also, a reminder to like us on Facebook so you can actually continue in the conversation as we post information throughout the week. And it's always interesting to see some back and forthness with our listeners and our community at large. Also, you can contact us anytime at our email account, which is, of course, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com.
So also very easy to remember.
Well, there is a consistent theme.
Mm-hmm. We try to do that.
All right. Let's go ahead. We have Brian on the line. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. How are you guys?
I'm doing well, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Hey, listen, you know, real interesting discussion, and, you know, all these discussions are interesting. But the fact is, you know, and I'm going to do a macro with you, okay? This is what our government, you know, has been getting away with for a long time, and they've excelled it, you know, since I think the Bush administration. You know, we could go back further than that, of course. But, you know, the problem is if you go to Chile, if you go to, you know, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras today, you know, we have assisted in setting up legal systems that look great on paper, and you see, you know, I don't have to school anybody in the results. And this is, you know, ultimately, you know, this, that was a test lab for the United States. You know, basically, you know, we did this, and you know, thousands and thousands of people have been killed, persecuted, and just driven into utter poverty and servitude because of these laws that are on the books and these grand juries. And, you know, we can argue them, you know, my philosophy is you can argue with an honest man and come to a resolve. A dishonest man, there's no sense in arguing with. And because they're always going to find the loophole, and they're always going to find the way around it. And when they don't, they'll just do it anyway. And this is what's happened in our country. This is what's happening in our legal system. And we don't know whether the victims of it are actually right and wrong. They're just on the wrong side of the people in power. And I really, it's not entertaining, it's not funny, it's beyond sarcasm, it's a tragedy that it's actually happening in the United States. But, you know, we've seeded these systems all over the world, you know, and you can go anywhere from South America to Asia, and now over to the Middle East, and the corruption that we've seeded is just coming home. It's kind of like what Malcolm said, the chickens are coming home to roost. Have a nice day.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And really, like, you look at the other things that our government is involved in, and the notion that they're going to throw three anarchists in prison for a longish amount of time for no ostensible reason is maybe actually not that surprising. I mean, if you consider the routine targeting of people based on their race or their nationality or their, you know, their class position, their sexuality, whatever it is, the notion that that same system would also target people based on their ideology, like, almost seems too obvious a point to make.
And yet, it's an important point to make, because I think that to, you know, to a lot of, you know, people who have not studied history, to a lot of average Americans who, you know, get all of their understanding about our political systems from their eighth grade civics class, This is unthinkable.
Right.
Or from some, I'm trying to think of the TV series that, you know, no, Law and Order, from Law and Order, for something like Law and Order, yeah. I don't watch TV, they start going out of my mind.
But yeah, you know, when that's your primary idea of how the system works, then to hear something like people are being held in solitary confinement for months, possibly a couple of years, you know, because what? They have not been charged with a crime. They have not been convicted of a crime.
Because they've been given immunity.
You see? Oh, yes. And
the immunity here means that we can put you in prison without trial.
I don't think they know what that would mean.
Interesting definition of immunity.
It's a change. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's go ahead and talk to Scott. Good morning, Scott. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. How you doing?
Doing well.
Yeah, I just had a question because I guess it's about the anarchist movement. And so, because I heard earlier that it's against environmentalists. So I guess it's just specifically the anarchist movement that you're talking about, or those at the federal prison by SeaTac, I guess? Because, you know, the environmentalist, and so, but anyways, I did a simple search last summer here in Portland, Oregon, and, trying to find about third-party tracking cookies on my computer and stuff like that, you know? And then I go into what they consider terrorists, you know, like, and you go into it, and they have the anarchists, they have ELF, ALF, all those people. And so, apparently, you know, they've been around for a long time. I guess one lady just turned herself in right up in Northern Washington not too long ago, came down from Canada, turned herself in. So, if you're one of those radicals like that, then you're already on their list, is what I'm saying. So it just takes a simple search thing like that. And so, but it's saying that it's against environmentalists. No, I don't think so.
Well, okay, Scott, let's hold on just for a moment. Stay where you are. I don't want to lose you.
Okay.
But I think what Christian was saying, and perhaps Christian, you could say it better than I, is that there's different targets for the sort of political repression from time to time. Currently, it seems to be directed against anarchists and anarchist community.
Okay.
Certainly 15 years ago, 20 years ago, in the early to mid 90s, it was being used. 10 years ago, actually, into the early 2000s, it was being used against several people in the environmentalist movement, necessarily anarchist identified, though not necessarily not.
ELF and ALF,
Rod Coronado, for example, and on. So, prior to that, looking at it being used against Black Panther movement, looking at it being used against the Puerto Rican independence movement, looking at it being used at really serious, any time that a group of people are seriously challenging state power.
Oh, yeah. Like when I grew up, I grew up in Goleta in Santa Barbara, California, and I'm almost 58, give away my age, doesn't mean a thing anyways. But, then in California was Watts riots, Berkeley riots, and Isla Vista riots, and Isla Vista is the college community for UC Santa Barbara,
So
and that was Weathermen back then in Isla Vista, and also Symbiote Liberation Army, and all kinds of crazy stuff through the years. And those out there just,
So, Scott, what is your point, though? What is your point?
Less than that, so. I don't know, just, all environmentalists, I don't know. But, the fringe ones, the fringe ones. And so, if they're suspect and on their list, then that's going to happen nowadays,
So you're just sort of, if I'm catching you right, you're saying, well, people should know better than to get involved in radical thought or communities that want to challenge state power.
Well, there's ways of challenging state power, and there's ways of not. Take for instance, if you want to get things changed in this country, then you have to present it to the Supreme Court justices, and that's the only way it's going to be changing. And what did we see recently where somebody challenged it, made a movie about some bogus movie about Hillary Clinton, and then it wasn't shown on television or broadcast? And what do we have now? Yeah, so we got to present it, not protest it. And, Occupy is a good thing, and they need to present it as well. See, there's ways to go about things, and there's ways not to go about things. But this radical stuff, fringe stuff, has been going on for years, and so they got to expect it,
Yeah, I don't actually have to expect political repression. I don't accept that. Just got to say.
J. Hoover and McCarthyism, talking about that way back then, we're a bunch of flaming commie whatevers, and...
Fact that it happens doesn't make it right. Right, Scott?
True. But okay. Then, they were targeting people who were doing nothing, like Louis Armstrong and people like that doing absolutely nothing.
Well, and I think here we have the same point, that there are people doing nothing.
We got these fringe people, and it's gotten that bad. So they got to realize, and then...
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyways, as far as like the drones and all that, I'm not for the drone attacks and all that and singling out the radicals in America and other places in Earth. But you take a look at the, well, you know, a lot of people nowadays don't like the United Nations. Well, what the newest book I bought is called World Religions and Norms of War.
We're drifting, Scott.
By the UN University.
We're drifting a little bit, Scott.
Well, they kill non-combatants. So if they don't like
Scott,
it,
take a breath.
All right. Well, thank you. Have a good one. Bye.
Thank you.
Okay, well.
I just wanted him to take a breath for a minute.
And get back to, in fact, grand jury resistance.
Yeah.
I guess my point is, you know, the fact that it happens, don't make it right. And the fact that it happens, don't mean we got to accept it. That's pretty much, you know, where I'm coming from. And the idea that if you're on the fringe of the political community, you might as well go ahead and accept and expect this sort of treatment, I think is pretty much anathema to living in a so-called free society. Of course, we could get into that. But
that's a whole nother program.
And, Lynn, what's coming up on KABU?
Well, you know what's coming up on KABU this morning. At 9 o'clock, One Land, Many Voices presents a talk by Israeli writer and activist Miko Peled, author of General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an interview with Peter Kuznick, co-writer with Oliver Stone of the book and documentary series The Untold History of the United States. Also, excerpts from a new documentary about the fight to save the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. And at 11 on the radio scene, Portland artist Baba Wage talks about his recent visit to his homeland of Mali. Oh, poor Mali these days. And there, the war there, the people, their struggles, and the differences between what he learned from the people and what the media are reporting about Mali. It should be very interesting. Thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. We really, really appreciate it. If you're not a KABU member, this can be easily remedied. Just go on to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
All righty. And again, just to remind you, you are listening to Positively Revolting here on your community radio station. And I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we have with us Christian Williams from the Committee Against Political Repression. I'm determined to rename your committee this morning. Yeah, sure. I've looked at your website. Sure, I've read your stuff. And I'm still determined to rename your committee this morning. So we are here talking about grand jury resistance and the grand jury system being used as a tool of political repression. Let's go ahead and talk to Charles, who joins us. If you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. We know in as studiers of history, there's usually a stampede right at the end of the show when we can't take any more calls. So please get it in there early. We'd love to hear from you. 503-231-8187. Also, please like us on Facebook. I love saying that. I don't know why. It's just like,
that's
please
good.
Like
you
us.
Didn't used to care for it. I'm glad that you like it
now. You know, Facebook. What can you say? But there it is, a tool. You can check us out at facebook.com/positivelyrevolting. You can also email us and stay in touch that way, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ani, Lynn, Christian. Thank you all. I think one thing I would have liked to hear more of is, and maybe Christian can comment, is that this is a pretty disgusting human rights violation. I mean, some people are, you know, justice from the government. But we have three young people, nobody over the age of 25, and the only way they can communicate with the rest of their people in their country is through P.O. Box 13900 in Seattle at the Federal Detention Center. And I hope that, you know, some people may not be interested in sending financial assistance to anarchists, but I think that these are three brave young people who express themselves, and we should be encouraging more people to express themselves to the government, to write expressive letter to the United States Attorney for Washington, Western District of Washington, and I hope we can look to see some information from Chris about how, even if it might not be influential, we can individually express support to Matt, Maddie, and KDO, and also avenues for trying to get the government to do something good to these good young people before the 18-month term of the grand jury maybe ends. So if we can have any input from Chris on that, or Christian, I'd be glad to hear it.
All right, Charles, thanks very much for your call this
now,
morning.
Do they get mail?
Yes, they do get mail, and I'm glad that that came up because I should have mentioned it earlier. They've been getting quite a bit of mail, and it's very important to them that it keep coming. It's really helping them feel like they're still connected to the movement, helping them keep their spirits up, letting them know that they're not alone. It's very we have heard from all three of them that the mail that they get is like the most important thing that they have going on. So yes, please do write them. The address and the instructions about what is allowable and such, you can again find on the CAPR website, which is nopoliticalrepression.wordpress.com. Also, people have been sending them books, which are very appreciated. Again, there are limits as to what can get in and how many books they can have and all that kind of stuff, but the details there are at the website. In terms of writing the U.S. attorney, Matt Duran and Katie Olesnik's lawyers are collecting letters that they are going to at some point deliver to Jenny Durkin. If you go to the, again, if you go to the No Political Repression website, there is a link there to an article from The Stranger in Seattle where they talk about what exactly they're doing and the people to address the letters to and then the addresses to send them to, which are separate people. So, yeah, people who are interested in writing letters to the government explaining that this is unconscionable should do that, should send it to Matt or KDO's attorneys, and the instructions for that you can find at the website. In terms of the human rights abuse, I mean, one of the things that I think is most distressing about this is the use of solitary confinement, which is widely recognized as a form of torture, can be debilitating for people in really very short amounts of time, produces intense psychological stress and distress, and can also produce physical symptoms related to the stress. It is among the more devastating torture techniques in use presently, and the has the benefit from the perspective of the state of not sounding like very much. Like, right. We're, everybody spends time alone, big deal. But
Angela Davis
weeks
said that
alone, it really can be bad for you.
Angela Davis said the only reason she made it through is that she had been a graduate student and spent so much time alone reading, and that she also practiced yoga, but that it was like a touch and go for, that was the hardest thing that she ever did was solitary confinement.
It is, it is a form of torture. And there's a lot of, psychological evidence that one can read about exactly how devastating that can be for a person to be isolated. We are human beings, social creatures. It is part of our makeup. So to that end, keep those cards and letters going. And again, you can get the addresses and instructions on writing prisoners from the CAPR website, and which I've posted a link to on our Facebook page.
Good. Because it's also on, and it's also on the KBOO on our episode page today. So,
yes.
And on the KBOO.FM website.
It is that as well. So we just have a few minutes left. I really want to talk a little bit more about a couple of things. One, do you have information what to do if you yourself find that you are suddenly subpoenaed by a grand jury? If you are in the hot seat, uh-huh. What happens? Where can you get support? Where can you get information?
I certainly hope anyone who gets a subpoena will contact the Committee Against Political Repression. We're pretty focused on this particular investigation, but we will loan whatever support we can to people who are in similar situations, and if nothing else, we'll help you find people who can focus more specifically on supporting that. Getting in touch with people, making it a political issue and not simply a legal issue, I think, is absolutely the key to this. The legal game is the part that the state controls. You know, they, like, the prosecutor has more or less unchecked power within the grand jury system. The consequences for them politically are the part that we can control. And so that's the area that we have to, like, we have to marshal our strength, and we have to find ways to pressure them to make it politically unacceptable for this sort of thing to happen, rather than simply thinking of it as a legal battle and the kind of thing that your lawyer is going to be able to talk you out of. So anyone who gets a subpoena, I would urge them to find people to help them, to make a public issue of it, to organize around it. And yeah, and get in touch with
the Do not go silently into that horrible night.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And also, look, our intern reminds us that we also have Twitter, which Lynn and I, God knows, we forget about. But our intern is there to keep us in touch. It's a wonderful thing.
It is indeed.
And you can follow us on Twitter, where
Thank
we are,
you, Sarah.
In fact, Positive Revolt. Still, you know, sort of keeping with the theme. And with our last few minutes remaining, a little bit more on how to support the people that are currently wrapped up in the grand jury system. Yes, we can go to your website, but just briefly, can you talk to folks about generally letter writing to prisoners and that sort of thing, guidelines?
Each prison has its own rules, so it's hard to generalize. Yeah. We have not heard very many complaints about things not getting in. Photocopied pages are fine. Like, handwritten letters are fine. Like, the as long as you can fit it in the envelope, it seems to get through. The most important thing there, it doesn't have to be a masterpiece of literature that you send them. The most important thing there is to break that sense of isolation, to make them feel like they are appreciated, that they are connected, that there is a movement behind them and supporting them.
And it's good to practice writing actual letters. And again, so people can remember how to do that.
That's true.
That's just
getting
a thought.
To be a lost art. Uh-huh. Lynn likes that art. I also wanted to point out that Maddie Pfeiffer requests that all letters are printed. They're much easier for them to read if they are printed letters because of dyslexia. So that's important to keep in mind. There's also a very wonderful letter from Maddie on the CAPER website that is talking about how important those letters of support are and how much they are appreciating, you know, cute pictures of animals and that sort of thing, too. Right. Again, just breaking that sense of isolation and showing that they're not forgotten. Any last thoughts, Christian?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. And again,
let our listeners know a little bit about CAPER, actually, and your work.
Sure. We formed because of the situation when the raise happened in July, when the subpoenas came down at that point, we saw a need to not simply hand this off to lawyers and hope for the best, and to have a community support element to it and to make a political issue of it. So, mostly people who were in the same sort of social scene as the people who were being targeted got together and then have been organizing a lot since then.
A whole lot?
A whole lot. More than I like to think about, actually.
Yeah, I could tell from the look on your face at that moment. You've been busy, haven't you? I really do want to thank you for taking the time and joining us this morning.
Indeed. And next week, we have folks that we've wanted to have for a long time, the Depavers.
We do.
Mm-hmm. And they are coming up.
And our intern, Sarah, will be, in fact, doing that show
mm-hmm.
with, possibly one of the two of us, but possibly not, as things are shifting around and a little bit crazy for us at this particular moment of our lives. But at least you'll have Sarah
And she's really fun. You guys need to tune in and see what kind of fun you can have with Sarah and the Sarah Snead and the Depavers. It sounds like a great new rock band to me.
I think it is a great new rock band. Thanks very much for listening. Once again, to remind you to stay in touch with us, email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook, where you can find us at /positivelyrevolting. And follow us on Twitter.
On the Twitters, as we say.
Indeed, indeed. Where you can find us at Positive Revolt. All right. Thanks very much for listening. And we will, in fact, be back again, at least parts of us. We'll be back again next week. Take care. Stay listening to KBOO as One Land, Many Voices is up next.
Is excited to be a media sponsor for the 36th Portland International Film Festival, presented by the Northwest Film Center. This year, 93 features and 46 short films from more than 36 countries will screen until February 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/PIFF2013.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is 8:58 a.m. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, One Land, Many Voices presents a talk by Israeli writer and activist Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. His talk was recorded in Seattle recently. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an interview with Peter Kuznick, co-writer with Oliver Stone of the book and documentary series The Untold History of the United States. Also, excerpts from a new documentary about the fight to save the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, Portland artist Baba Wage talks about his recent visit to his homeland of Mali, the war there, the people, their struggles, and the differences between what he learned from the people and what the media are reporting about Mali. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous and ongoing support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and click on the jar labeled Donate Today.
Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Singer. Wael Elassadi is out for this program, and this program is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking phone calls. Today we're going to be listening to a lecture by Miko Peled. Miko Peled is an Israeli writer and activist living in San Diego. His book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, follows the development of the Israeli-Palestinian struggle from a national and personal perspective. Miko Peled was born in Jerusalem in 1961. His grandfather was a Zionist leader and signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father, Mati Peled, was a young officer in the War of 1948 and a general in the War of 1967 when Israel conquered the West Bank, Gaza, Golan, and the Sinai. Mati Peled later called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory. The 1997 death of Miko Peled's niece in a suicide bombing propelled him into a journey of discovery, pushing him to re-examine beliefs he had grown up with as part of the Zionist political military elite. The journey transformed him into a visionary activist in the struggle for human rights and lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. And now we go to the lecture, delivered in October of last year in Seattle.
I always begin my remarks with a disclaimer, and that disclaimer is this.